Us Northerners working together on both sides of the border. You have a lot of family ties on either side. I think it's going to benefit both Alaska and the Northwest Territories.
Canada asks for Alaska's help maintaining the country's polar bear hunt. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 24th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an excavation project unearths 100-year-old remains near Wasilla.
It was not what we expected, and so that in itself is devastating.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Let's Cite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Let's Cite Alaska. You can discover Let's Cite Alaska at LITSITE.org. Let's Cite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
A former Alaska lawmaker will serve 6 months in a federal prison following her conviction on corruption charges. Beverly Masick was sentenced today in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. Masick pleaded guilty in March to conspiring to accept $4,000 from former VECO chief executive Bill Allen, the man tied to convictions of a handful of other lawmakers. Prosecutors say Masick acted at Allen's request to kill a bill that would have raised crude oil taxes. VECO was a company that did maintenance, design, and construction work for oil companies. Masick, a Republican, represented the Matanuska-Susitna area in the State House from 1995 to 2004. The first meeting of a U.S.-Russia bilateral polar bear commission is taking place in Moscow this week. State and federal game managers are meeting with their Russian counterparts to work on developing a framework for how to manage the shared polar bear population in the Chukchi Sea for long-term sustainability. Doug Vincent Lang is a special assistant with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Vincent Lang says the commission's first focus is on designing a joint research program to assess how many polar bears live in the Chukchi.
And then second of all, try to design a program to figure out how many polar bears are harvested both on the U.S. side and the Russian side, and assure that, and try to set a limit so that those harvests are conducted at a sustained level and don't threaten the long-term viability of those polar bear populations.
Russia has not allowed hunting of polar bears for either sport or subsistence since the 1950s, but Vincent Lang says it's acknowledged that there are still some taken by subsistence hunters each year. He says they'll work to understand how many, but he says climate change, not hunting, is the polar bear's biggest threat.
Hunting was not identified as a major factor leading to or threatening the long-term viability of polar bears. And that's largely because hunting is across the range of polar bears is conducted in a sustainable manner.
That kind of statement is welcome news to a member of Canada's Northwest Territorial Government. Jackie Jacobson is a Legislative Assembly member representing Nunukput. Jacobson was in Alaska last week meeting with Doug Vincent Lang and other state and federal officials to see if an agreement can be reached to resume transferring polar bears across the Canada-Alaska border that are taken by American sports hunters in Canada. Jacobson says the immediate halt to those border transfers of polar bear hides and meat after the ESA listing has directly impacted 85 families in his riding or district.
It's a $1.7 million hit to my riding. It doesn't seem like much, but when you have a riding of probably about 3,600 people at the most, it does affect us with our airlines, hotels, and the sport hunters and the helpers and overall community. It's a big effect. It affected us greatly. I represent Tuktoyaktuk, Sax Harbor, Politoc, and Ulukaktuk.
Jacobson says Canadian officials agree that polar bear populations need to be managed carefully, but they believe the polar bear numbers in Canada are robust.
We signed on an agreement, a species of special concern, but not a species at risk. We have a really good management system in place, which each community has 26 tags, which are 13 tags for local Aboriginal subsistence hunting, and then you have 13 tags for general sport hunting. But now we're not selling those tags, and then it's being put back into the mix, and our polar bear population is a healthy population. And
when polar bears were listed under the ESA, it triggered the Marine Mammal Protection Act that mandates any part of a listed animal cannot be transferred across U.S. borders. The state's biologist, Vincent Lang, says because two-thirds of the world's polar bears live in Canada, a well-regulated hunt is not perceived as a threat to their survival.
The state's view on this is that as long as those hunts are conducted in sustainable manners and they're not threatening the viability of those polar bear populations, and there was also a trigger in there that under U.S. law that the U.S. government had to certify those hunts as sustainable, we don't have any trouble with those hunts continuing.
Alaska Congressman Don Young has introduced a bill that would allow American hunters to bring polar bear carcasses killed in Canada back into the U.S. The bill would amend the Marine Mammal Protection Act. It was referred to a Natural Resources Subcommittee in February, where it's awaiting action. The Kinnick Tribal Council is anticipating that DNA testing will reveal more information on 100-year-old human remains recently unearthed near Wasilla. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, an excavation project at the old Kinnick town site brought the remains to light in August.
When a human skull was unearthed on August 15th, work stopped immediately on a foundation dig that the Wasilla Kinnick Historical Society was conducting as part of a museum expansion project. The state medical examiner's office has determined that the skull belonged to a young Alaska Native.
Just from the skull, there was a determination that it was a young adult or late teenager, young adult, possibly male or female. And probably native due to the physical features of the skull, which that was determined by the state archaeologists.
Franz Seeger-Boss is the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's cultural resources specialist.
Graves had been reported in that region, but we didn't know exactly where. And we were concerned that even though ground-penetrating radar had been conducted, that there still was a chance that remains may be found. And so we monitored the situation at the time the heavy equipment came in. We monitored every bucket that came out of the soil.
Seeger-Boss says there was no indication that there were any graves in the immediate dig area. She was on site when the skull was unearthed. That find led to the rest of the remains.
We were moving dirt away to discern where the skull may have come from, and we did find where it came from, and it came from within the wall of the foundation. And so basically we had disturbed about 2 feet of the possible coffin and individual. And most of the remaining human remains are still in the wall.
Seeger-Boss says the remains, located last weekend, were left on site, still buried in a crude coffin. The Kinnick Tribal Council met this week to decide to reinter the remains in the tribal cemetery in Kinnick. Deborah Call is the president of the Kinnick Tribal Council.
It was not what we expected. And so that in itself is devastating because after the state medical examiner and the physical anthropologist, you know, reviewed the remains and the determination was made that it was a young Alaska Native male between the ages, you know, 15 and 25, I believe, and the remains are about 75 to 100 years old, that certainly put it within arm's reach of, say, an immediate relative. And that is not a good thing. And that's the reason why we've requested DNA testing.
Tribal officials are hoping that DNA tests may reveal who the young person was and who his descendants might be. Call says uncovering the grave is basically disrespecting the grave, and that is disturbing to Alaska Natives. She says the Tribal Council will meet again this weekend to discuss the matter further.
On many counts, yes, I would have liked to not have it discovered. But on the other hand, you know, whether or not there's a positive side to this, it warrants the thought process to know that Dena'ina people lived here and there was a soul buried there that is now disturbed. And the tribe, unfortunately or fortunately, I mean, depending upon how you want to look at it, we have to take care of it now. And it's like a death of a family member. And it's going to be even more real when we realize it may be related to one of us.
The location of the museum excavation is near the K'nick Tribal Cemetery and adjacent to a swampy area that has been filled over the years with backfill and just plain junk from long ago old K'nick town residents. It is in this swampy area that the remains were found, and Seeger Boss says the find was unexpected. The Matanuska Sioux City Borough has agreed to pay for DNA testing and for the reburial of the remains. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a family in Wrangell struggles with their son's rare speech disorder.
One day I was getting him some juice, and I wouldn't let him have the juice until he was going to say juice. And at that point, he just got really, really frustrated.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Senator Lisa Murkowski's attempt to temporarily limit the Environmental Protection Agency's power died on the Senate floor today. Democratic leadership blocked a vote on her amendment. It would have kept the EPA from regulating greenhouse gas emissions from stationary sources like industrial plants. Murkowski wanted a year-long time out during which the EPA wouldn't institute new rules while Congress works on its climate change legislation. Environmentalists loudly protested, saying her plan would handcuff the EPA. The agency could still regulate mobile polluters like cars and trucks, but environmentalists say it would give a pass to other major emitters of greenhouse gases. Murkowski spoke on the Senate floor today in support of her amendment. She said stationary sources of greenhouse gases don't just include power plants. It also includes office buildings, hospitals, and schools, and she says regulating them could have unanticipated consequences.
Very clearly, stationary sources must reduce emissions in order to bring our nation to its climate goals, but forcing them to do so through the Clean Air Act would be one of the least efficient and most damaging ways to pursue that goal. It would be rife with unintended consequences and, I believe, potentially devastating for our economy.
The EPA is developing its plans for regulating greenhouse gas emissions in the wake of a 2007 Supreme Court decision that ruled carbon dioxide is a pollutant that can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. Murkowski tried to attach her amendment to an interior and environment spending bill. It's not yet known if she'll try to find another way to move her measure forward. The directors of the U.S. Missile Defense Program assured Congress today that interceptor rockets in Alaska are a key component to the country's overall defense strategy. Last week, the Obama administration announced its changing plans for missile defense in Europe. That has Alaska's congressional delegation concerned there might also be changes in store for the system at Fort Greely in Delta Junction. Fort Greely houses ground-based interceptors that are designed to shoot down long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs. The Obama administration says the greater threat from Iran is from short-range attack. But today, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Michelle Flournoy, says nothing has changed in Alaska. She told the Senate Armed Services Committee that Alaska's ground-based interceptors, or GBIs, are still important to the system.
We will still have 30 GBIs deployed in the United States by the end of 2010, which will provide the United States with a sufficient capability to deal with any Iranian ICBM threat for many years to come.
President Obama announced last week he's scrapping plans to base interceptor rockets in Poland and a radar system in the Czech Republic. Instead, he's opting for a mobile, less expensive system that is considered more adaptable and better at shooting down short-range missiles. The new plan is supported by the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Today, senators from both sides of the political aisle blasted the Obama administration for the way last week's announcement was made. Congress had no heads up, and U.S. allies in Europe were taken by surprise. Wrangell residents were geared up last weekend in support of a local child who has a rare disorder. Carter Hammer was diagnosed with childhood apraxia of speech, or CAS, when he was 3 years old. Since then, his family had to make adjustments and receive outside help in order to accommodate his needs. The 2009 Wrangell Walk for CAS took place last weekend in an effort to raise awareness about Carter's disorder. KSTK's Tony Gorman has the story.
It's another typical Sunday at Grandpa and Grandma's house for 5-year-old Carter Hammer. He gets a snack and then goes downstairs to play with his Hot Wheels and racing games on Nintendo 64. Carter sounds like any other child, except he has childhood apraxia of speech, also known as CAS. CAS is a neurological disorder that affects motor speech skills. Children with CAS are aware when people are talking to them but have difficulty responding back. Carter's mother, Holly, remembers when they first noticed something out of the ordinary when he was only one. She says at the time she wanted to see if he was relying on his older brothers and sisters to talk.
One day I was getting him some juice and I wouldn't let him have the juice until he was going to say juice. And at that point he just got really, really frustrated and just started yelling and getting very upset. And that's when I definitely knew that something was not right.
Carter's father, Clay, says he and Holly patiently waited to hear Carter's first words. He says some family members thought that if Carter had something to say, he would say it at a later time. But time went on, and he still had a hard time getting the words out.
And he still wasn't able to address his siblings by any form of a name, be it a nickname that they come up with there on their own, even if they can't necessarily pronounce the whole name correctly. He didn't even have that. And at that point, we knew that something was just not quite coming around.
That's when the Hammers took Carter down to Children's Hospital in Seattle, where he was diagnosed with CAS. Before the diagnosis, the Hammers had never heard of the disorder. They say if they had heard of the CAS, they would have gotten him help sooner.
The prevalence of CAS has been reported differently.
Deborah Hayden is the founder and CEO of the Prompt Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where they have worked with thousands of children with speech disorders since the early 80s. She says CAS is very rare among most cases.
The current estimates are probably around 3-4% of children, maybe in, say, a study of 12,000 to 15,000 estimated children who have speech sound disorders, maybe 3% of those might be classified as childhood apraxia speech. But even that number is probably inflated.
Since Carter's diagnosis, the Hammers have made efforts to learn more about CAS by attending conferences about the disorder. This past summer, they attended a Childhood Apraxia of Speech Association of North America, or CASANA, conference in Chicago. Clay says he and Holly learned that though the disorder is rare, it is still prominent among families.
It was just amazing how much input that there was from all these different families. We were able to meet other families that were going through the same exact issues as we were. And you sit down and family to family compare notes. It was amazing, all the similarities. And it was also very encouraging to compare notes with some of the families that had very good success.
The family admits that it has been a challenge adjusting to Carter. In order to communicate with them, they have to use sign language most of the time. Carter is capable of saying some words. A lot of them has to be broken up so that he can understand them.
Yeah. Oh, he has another dog. What's your other dog's name?
E.
Gracie. So he'll say E-E.
I'm Holly.
Oh, he just learned my name. Can you say Holly?
Hi.
That's how he says Holly. He just learned that like last week.
Other family members have adjusted to Carter very well. Carter's grandfather, Don McConaughey, says adjusting is the other way around. He says he is always helpful every time he visits.
You know, he's just a great little guy. He's a hard worker. He's always very, very helpful. If you're coming in from grocery shopping, he needs to carry something upstairs because he wants to be there in the middle of helping, and that's kind of a little guy he is.
Along with helping out with chores, playing video games, and sports, Carter enjoys swimming at the local Parks and Recreation Center. Carter began taking swim lessons last summer along with other kids. Victoria Martin is his swim teacher. She says Carter is very spirited every time he hits the water.
I haven't picked all that much up, but we never have a problem communicating. He understands completely. Even though he doesn't have words, Carter is a very intelligent child. And you see that in his eyes. You see that he comprehends. I mean, I never have any discipline problems with him. He always listens. He always follows directions. So I guess if there were any challenges, it probably were my own, not his.
Resources are limited in Wrangell, Alaska, so getting the treatment that Carter needs can be hard to come by. He currently sees a local speech-language pathologist daily and attends regular kindergarten classes at Evergreen Elementary School. The Hammers will be taking Carter to the Prompt Institute, where he will go through intensive training and therapy. Reporting from Wrangell, I'm Tony Gorman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
The Fairbanks Borough Assembly considers an ordinance tonight that would re-establish a long-dormant recycling commission. Tonight's action follows the Assembly's passage earlier this month of a 5-cent plastic shopping bag fee to fund recycling. Assembly member Mike Music chaired a 2008 recycling task force and voted against the bag fee. Music says it would have been better to reestablish the recycling commission and let it develop a way to fund a program, but he's prepared to move ahead.
We'll try to maintain as much of a bottoms-up, grassroots approach to recycling as we can. And to me, the first thing that we need to spend money is on education, teach people to recycle. But in order to do that, they have to have a place to bring their materials. And we know that's not going to happen overnight. But we also know that there are these entities that are recycling now. And, for example, the Rescue Mission just started. Walmart has recycling.
Music says he hopes the bag fee, which is opposed by the major retailers it applies to, does not hurt the store's recycling efforts. Walmart accepts and backhauls recyclables and recently provided a $35,000 grant to the Fairbanks Rescue Mission to aid the nonprofit's new recycling program. Fairbanks store manager Tim Erickson says the bag fee won't affect Walmart's recycling efforts.
My biggest issue with the bag fee itself is that obviously it negatively affects my customers. It doesn't necessarily affect my recycling program because my recycling program has been up and running for 20 or 21 months. So we'll continue to take care of number one and number two plastics. Newspapers, we'll do our annual phone book recycling, and we'll continue to do things like support the rescue mission, those kind of things. So really it isn't going to have much of an impact on currently what I'm doing as far as recycling.
Erickson says the borough bag fee will likely result in fewer plastic bags going out of his store and save Walmart money. Bag fee sponsor, Assembly Presiding Officer Nadine Winters, intended the charge to cut the number of bags going into the waste stream and littering the community, as well as to provide startup funds for local recycling efforts. It's unclear how much the 5-cent fee will generate because stores won't say how many plastic bags they give out, but it's estimated to be hundreds of thousands. Winter says some of the bag fee revenue will provide a plastic bag alternative.
A reusable bag program, because this was never meant to be onerous on anybody who shops. And so the ordinance explicitly has a section that allows the bag fee revenue to be spent on a reusable bag program.
Beyond that, Winter says bag fee revenue can be used to cover startup costs for recycling efforts because proceeds will fall off. Winter says bag fee money can't be spent on staffing and administration, but can be used for infrastructure like sorting and baling machines or an incinerator. She says she'll leave investigation of such options up to the Recycling Commission the Assembly considers establishing tonight. The 6th annual Homer Documentary Film Festival kicks off tonight at the Homer Theater. As KBBI's Casey Kelly reports, the festival brings some of the year's most acclaimed documentary films to town.
Festival curator Jamie Sutton says he's been a fan of documentaries since the third grade, when he was
inspired by a teacher I had that showed me Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame.
Documentaries used to have small, fairly specialized audiences, but Sutton says the success of filmmakers like Michael Moore, director of Roger and Me, Bowling for Columbine, and Sicko, combined with the fact that you can produce a high-quality documentary for pretty cheap, means studios are putting more money into them than they used to.
So a lot of really interesting things are being pursued, and the quality of documentary films has really gotten terrific.
One of the films in this year's lineup that's sure to be a crowd pleaser is The Cove. According to this trailer on the film's website, it won the Audience Award at this year's Sundance Film Festival.
I do want to say that we try to do the story legally.
There it is. A little town with a really big secret.
The Cove is the story of a group of activists and filmmakers who went to Japan and penetrated the little-known world of catching dolphins for captivity. Sutton says it's more than just a documentary.
It's kind of an adventure movie in addition to telling a story about the dolphins and their plight.
Then there's Tyson, which profiles former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson.
To be honest, I'm a jerk sometimes, and I think things that sometimes crash.
He took me in his house. He didn't even know me.
When I first come here, I said, wow, I could rob these white guys.
Even if you don't like boxing, it's as a study of a person, it's really it's fascinating.
Along the way, I became a very proud father of six kids.
I'm fighting, but all of a sudden I'm getting hit. Boom, boom, pow, pow. And the next thing I know, the fight has stopped. I was an ex-champion.
Other films include Afghan Star, Every Little Step, Unmistaken Child, It Might Get Loud, Valentino, and Food, Inc.
The way we eat has changed more in the last 50 years than in the previous 10,000. The modern supermarket has on average 47,000 products.
The industry doesn't want you to know the truth about what you're eating.
This is a really thoughtful and sort of deliberate discussion about where our food comes from, what the motivation is of the companies that produce it, and how they have maintained their grip. It's powerful stuff.
Sutton says the Documentary Film Festival has developed a devoted audience over the years. He says he looks forward to interacting with other fans of the genre.
People that are interested in the world and know that it'll be interesting and stimulating and thought-provoking.
This year's festival will feature an appearance by director Joel Bennett. He'll be on hand to answer questions following a screening of his film Mountains of Snow Leopard Saturday and Sunday. There will also be a Sunday night fashion show. A $35 festival pass is available, or else it's $7 apiece to see individual films. A full schedule is online at homertheater.com. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Tony Gorman in Wrangell, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Thread helps families make good choices about early care and education for their children. Formerly known as Child Care Connection, Thread connects families throughout Alaska with quality child care, family child care programs, licensed centers, preschool or Head Start programs at no cost. Thread offers parenting workshops, resources, and help with parenting issues. Find out more online at threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread, connecting early care and education to Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.